Welcome back to the Grief Observed podcast. I'm Brad Morrell, your host. And if you would like to join me on an episode, just find me on Facebook at facebook.com/griefobservedpodcast, or simply send me an email at griefobservedpodcast@gmail.com. I will have that in the show description. My next guest is Abby Keller, and she is an oncology RN. And we're just going to talk a little bit about grief and some of the experiences that she has as a nurse. And so I will be quiet and bring on Abby. Abby, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I'm glad we finally got to connect. We've chatted a little bit over Facebook, and just glad you're here. It's, you know, we were talking before we started about how sometimes there's people who have grief that is overlooked in certain ways. And it certainly sounds like you have some things to share about that in your own life. But why don't you begin just by telling us a little bit about who you are, and you can tell me as much or as little as you want to tell.
Okay, great. Thanks. So my name's Abby. I live in Virginia. I am an oncology nurse. I've been a nurse for over a decade now in oncology and stem cell transplant. And it's just been so rewarding. Like I love oncology nursing so much. It's definitely the thing I'm meant to do. Like, I feel like there's just some things that you're meant to do in life. And I think oncology nursing is that for me. And it's interesting. When I went to nursing school, I really had no idea what kind of nursing I wanted to do. I didn't have anybody in my family who was a nurse, so I didn't really know what nurses even did. I just kind of had this stirring in me that felt like that was right. And I loved science. So like, it just seemed to fit. And as I went through nursing school and figured out what nurses did, I was like, oh, this is cool. And it wasn't until my last year of nursing school that I went through a clinical rotation in oncology that it really stood out to me how special a specialty it is, how unique, and what a privilege it is to work with folks when they are living with cancer. And so if it's okay, I'd like to tell you a little story about the day that kind of made me realize that oncology was for me.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, to key in on that, I do believe people have a calling in life, and so many people go so far into life without even knowing what that is. I've mentioned several times, I'll be 49 in October, and I don't think that I really, I don't know, thought about my calling till I was about 42, maybe 44 is really when it solidified, and it was like, yes, this is what I'm meant to do. And so I don't know, I think it's great that you figured it out fairly early in life.
Yeah, I was very lucky. I it was like 21, and I was like, yeah, this seems good.
Yeah.
This seems right.
And that's so rare. Like, I think most of us have this identity crisis throughout most of our lives, not even knowing who we are. Not even, you know, you can put the calling to the side, like, what am I supposed to do? But who am I? Like, that's one of the biggest questions I think people are unsure of for most of their lives. So anyway,
I definitely didn't know that when I was 21. I knew I wanted to do oncology. I didn't know who I was, but we figured it out.
Good. Well, tell me your story.
Yeah. So this is the day that kind of, with more than a day, but this is the story that kind of made me fall in love with oncology. So, I showed up. Nursing students have clinical rotation. So, at my nursing school, we had to prep the day before. So you go to the hospital, you look up your assigned patient, you learn all about their medications, their medical history, all the things. You like write up a nursing plan of like all the things that they might be at risk for, all the things that you could do for them to improve their health, that kind of thing. So I did all my prep, and I walked in the next morning, say, "Hi, my name's Abby. I'm a nursing student." And the patient that I was prepared to care for all day and interact with was actively dying. And that was not something I had ever seen before.
Can I pause you right there
Yeah, sure.
and maybe ask you to explain to people when you're stating actively dying
Yeah.
versus, can you explain that to listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's illnesses that we consider terminal, but you can live quite a while with them and be functional. Actively dying really refers to the state in which your body is beginning to shut down. So a lot of times cognition is impaired, so people sleep a lot. They may or may not be lucid. They may or may not be able to communicate with you. Various organs begin to stop working. So, like kidneys, urine production ceases. So you don't go to the bathroom anymore. You don't eat because you're not hungry. Your digestive system starts to stop, and you're just kind of slowly. Your body's slowly stopping.
Yeah.
Breathing becomes slower, and there's lots of like physical signs that can show you if you're actively dying. This particular moment, he was breathing. He had a heartbeat, all of that, but he was no longer conscious. He had his mouth open, very big breathing. He was very dried out, but he was still there. And so I was planning on talking to him and getting to know him and seeing what I could do for him. And I just walked in and I was like at a loss. I didn't know what I could do. So I ended up spending that day, I think it was, I can't remember if it was 6 or 8 hours of clinical, just kind of sitting with him, talking to his wife, learning about him. I remember that he loved Frank Sinatra, so I'll call him Frank. Frank Sinatra was his favorite. He loved fried chicken and mashed potatoes. He was a volunteer firefighter. Like, I just remember all these little details that I didn't learn from him, I learned from his wife. And I just spent the day like holding his hand, doing mouth care, which is like moistening and just cleaning to make them comfortable and fluffing pillows, that kind of thing. And I left feeling like I didn't really do anything. I didn't help. And but I just felt really attached to Frank and his wife. It just felt like there was this moving, I don't know how to describe it other than love. Like love in a way that is just like this, I don't know, like you just love your patients sometimes, and I can't really describe it. It's not a romantic love, it's not a not family, but you just love them. And so I went back the next day in between classes to go to the hospital and just check on him, and his wife was so nice and introduced me to his kid, his adult children, and like, "Oh, this is Abby. We love her." And again, like, I was so honored and privileged. I hadn't done anything. Like, I didn't do anything to deserve this kindness and this welcome into this very intimate moment with this family. But they welcomed me in anyway. And I went back to, my school functions, and I was tearful. And my friends were like, "What is wrong with you?" And I was like, "Frank's dying." And they didn't understand. They're just college kids. We're all just college kids. And I realized the profound difference of like real life is happening in the hospital. And then you go back to your college campus and it feels like pretend life. Like we have all these stresses and everything in college, but it's different than the things that are going on in the hospital. And it was hard to see that juxtaposition as a young person. And I wrote a card to Frank's wife and gave it to her, just thanking her for the privilege of being there with them, and how much it had affected me. And I got a letter back weeks later, long after he had passed. It may have been months later, to my college housing, from his wife, saying like how much it had meant to her that we had, that I had come and been with them. And they had actually read my letter at Frank's funeral. The pastor read it at the funeral, and I had no idea that I could make an impact. Because again, like I didn't feel like I actually helped. I was just there. I was just an observer. And I feel like that experience of that profound privilege of being part of this intimate moment made me realize how powerful oncology nursing is and how nursing is in general, that we get to be there for those really hard moments. And even though we might not remember, I'll always remember Frank, but we might not remember all of those interactions that we have, but the family remembers and the patient remembers. Like you remember how people make you feel. And if you can make them feel loved and valued and witnessed, that's a really powerful place to be.
Yeah, I wonder how many people are not shown proper love throughout life, and then someone like yourself shows them truly an unconditional love. Yes, it's a professional thing that you're doing there, but at the same time, what if that's the only act of love this person has ever seen in life, you know? And it's not hard for me to state that because I work with a lot of people who have not been properly loved in life. I'm wondering if any patients have ever rejected that love and kindness from you. Have you ever experienced
Yeah,
that?
I think that there are different levels of acceptance of I think that there are people who, don't really, they don't need you to do that, or they don't want you kind of that close. And that's okay. That's their right. I think like our job is to show kindness regardless, but it's really up to the patient and the family of like how much they want to let us in.
So you've got a decade of working in oncology specifically.
Oncology, mostly inpatient nursing, and stem cell transplant. But I have done infusion nursing. I've done primary clinic nursing, all in oncology. And then I have a I launched a business in the last year in which I support folks living with cancer or post-cancer or their caregivers, help them navigate the healthcare system and navigate the complex emotions that come with cancer, living with it, living after it, or caring for somebody with it. Because it's really hard, and I think that there are a lot of skills that oncology nurses have that we're spread so thin, like we have so much work to do that we don't always get to do all the things that we wish we could do. Like we don't get to do the hand holding and the spend enough time and the education that and the advocacy that we wish we could. We do that every day, but sometimes you want to do it more and you just don't have the time or the space or the permission to do it. And so I hope I help folks one-on-one to get that extra support.
Yeah, we've had some people on here who have lost people to cancer. And at what point would someone reach out for your services?
I generally help while there's still somebody who is living with cancer. I find that if you've had a loved one pass from cancer, I would reach out to a grief specialist. I do a fair amount of grief work in my coaching, but generally not post-death. We do work with anticipatory grief, which we see a lot with caregivers, preparing for the death of their loved one, whether it's soon or whether it's just the threat of death in the future. Because that's really hard. If you have a loved one with cancer, you worry a lot.
Sure.
And you have to construct, like you're faced with the reality that like you might not always have this person, and you have to construct a concept of your life without them. And that's really, really hard. So I help people with that. I think like people living with or post cancer also experience levels of grief. It's interesting. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of grief, although not linear, not meant to be linear, were actually meant for the dying themselves, not for folks grieving a dying
Yeah.
person. Yeah. And so like I think that when you are diagnosed with cancer, you have to construct a world, a reality in which you might not always be there. And that's really hard, and it's really scary. And it's not something that everybody has to think about. And I think that there are also a lot of losses that aren't acknowledged when somebody's diagnosed with cancer or living with cancer.
Yeah, it,
That
I'm sorry, go ahead.
oh that that aren't always acknowledged by society, and that can be hard.
Yeah, in grief, we talk about a lot of secondary losses, whether that's financial security, maybe personal security, friendships change, things like that. Are those things that you address during cancer?
Yeah, absolutely. So a cancer is very expensive, and it changes your whole life. And so there are those losses that you experience, even if it's not loss of life. Maybe it's loss of a dream. Maybe it's loss of an expectation. I thought I was gonna be able to do XYZ. I thought I was gonna be healthy. I thought I was going to live longer than this. I thought I was going to watch my children get old. I think that there's a lot of loss. I thought that I would be able to move my body in a different way than I can move it currently. So sometimes those losses aren't just about life and death, but the way that you want to live. And I think that there needs to be space to grieve those losses as well, and to feel those losses and not just run away from them and cover them with, oh, I should be grateful that I'm alive, because that's a temptation of we don't want to appear like we're wallowing in self-pity. So we tend to cover up the sadness of the losses that come with something, because it's not the ultimate loss, right? Maybe you're not dying, but your life is a lot harder and more complicated than you thought. Maybe you can't work anymore, and that's really hard. Maybe you can't be the parent that you wanted to be, and that's, you have that loss of identity or that shift in identity. And so I think there needs to be room to process that as well.
Yeah, I think as people trying to console or help those going through sickness like that, we throw out some really poor consolation prizes sometimes, like, well, at least you get to do such and such, or at least, you're maybe not dying, or, congratulations, you're in remission. And it's like, okay, I know people are trying to be helpful, but at the same time, I don't think they recognize that something was taken from this person, even if death is not in the picture, that their lives are forever changed. I don't know.
As at least statements, I feel like they can be very dismissive, and it kind of makes the person be like, oh, I guess I shouldn't talk about this, or I guess I can't share how I'm actually feeling because I'm not supposed to be feeling like this, because at least I have this thing. I'm supposed to be grateful. I'm not supposed to be angry. I'm not supposed to be sad. And I think that there's a lot of pain in feeling like you're supposed to be feeling something at the wrong time, or you don't feel something that you feel like you're supposed to feel at that time. So like if you're not sad at the funeral, what's wrong with me? I'm not sad, I'm not crying, or like I'm not happy that I got this medical news. I'm actually sad, I'm still angry, but I'm supposed to be happy. And so there's a lot of pain in the expectations that your feelings are going to be XYZ and they're not. And it makes us question, like, what's wrong with me? Why don't I feel this way? And what if there's space to just feel it?
Yeah, I think we rob people of that space a lot of times, you know, that we're so quick to fill in the gaps. Like one of the things whenever I was going through school for counseling is they would state, okay, like for example, the first time I had to counsel someone, it was peer-to-peer counseling, but they said, I want you to counsel this person for 10 minutes without asking any questions. So we would use what we called minimal encouragers. We would go, or tell me more. Tell me more is not a question, but you're still getting something from someone. But the one that everybody dreaded was just staring at their client and waiting for them to fill in the gap. Because what happens is if there is space, any human will try to fill it because it's uncomfortable. So I think sometimes we need to just literally just shut up and let people fill their own space as opposed to us trying to do it because of us being uncomfortable, you know, because maybe we don't know the proper way to assist someone in a time of sickness or in a time of grief. We don't know what to do, so we just try to fill it with all the wrong things. I don't know. So I
Yeah,
think just leaving that room for someone.
I think you nailed it. I think that we tend to fill in. We try to comfort, we try to minimize, we try to fill the space so that we don't feel that discomfort. And I think that we could all do a little bit better at being comfortable with uncomfortable emotions. Like, yeah,
Yes.
it's hard to be sad. It's hard to be angry. It's hard to watch someone suffer. But if we always minimize or run away from those feelings, then we never actually learn how to let those feelings move through us so that we can get to the other side of them. I think that feelings become a lot bigger when you run from them. And I think grief does the same way. Like if you're always, you don't want to face your grief because it feels too big or too hard, it's not actually going to go away if you keep running from it. It's just going to get scarier.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I fault our school systems on is that, you know, we're taught more of I guess what to think, what to feel, what to study and regurgitate for a test. But I don't think we're taught how to think, first of all, and two, like how to deal with emotions. I think there needs to be more classes like that in school systems to say, okay, we know that the 30 of you kids come from way different homes, but let's talk about each emotion and what's this emotion mean to you? You know, I think those are some practical classes that we should be taught because by the time we get to you know, adult life, a lot of us don't know how to deal with emotions properly. You know, and I think a lot of it is we're not taught that in our homes either. You know, it's.
A lot of people don't even know how to name them. Like I feel like there are feelings that they don't even know how to get in touch with enough to name. And I think so naming would be the first step. Like, how do you feel? Because sometimes if you're like, how do you feel? People will say, I don't know, bad.
What
But
was that Pixar movie years ago that had all the different emotion
Inside
characters?
Out.
So maybe everybody should watch that movie to,
Yeah, I love that movie. It's very clever. And I think that what's interesting is that sadness, I'm not trying to spoil it, but sadness is the essential character. And you are like so frustrated with her the whole movie. You're like, stop touching stuff because she's like messing everything up. But Like she is the connector. Sadness connects us. There's no greater bonding agent than shared sadness. And so like that's one thing about grief that it is kind of beautiful to acknowledge of like when there is a shared loss, it can create a lot of issues, family issues, a lot of drama. But it can also bring people together in a really beautiful way.
Yeah. This is probably too early in the conversation to bring up this question, but if I don't, I'll forget about it. So with working with these individuals and in oncology and seeing a lot of death and grief from family, has it made you think about your own mortality?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I don't think that there's too many oncology professionals who aren't thinking about mortality more than the average person. I think that that was really hard for me when I was 21, 22 years old, and I would want to spend time with my friends who were just in, you know, internship jobs. They're in marketing or communications. And I'm like, everybody's dying. And you don't want to be the Debbie Downer. But I also didn't have room or people to process that with. And it does make you realize that life is so fragile because I'm taking care of patients my own age. I'm taking care of people who are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, like the everybody can get cancer and die. And it's really, really sad. You know, I've watched newlyweds, you know, say goodbye. I've watched young parents say goodbye to their young children. And I've seen you know, parents try to make it to their daughter's wedding and they can't make it. You know, like it can get you at any moment of that light of life, like any of these big moments that you think you will be guaranteed to you aren't. And so I'm definitely very aware that I don't know how long I'm going to live. I don't know how long my life's going to be. And I don't know how long the life of my loved ones is going to be. And that might be even harder. I think I've pre-grieved my parents quite a bit, which I don't know if that's healthy or not, but trying to imagine life without them is really hard, but I know that I'm going to have to if I don't go first, you know? So it makes every goodbye is sweeter and has to be more meaningful because you just never know, never know.
Yeah. Yeah, the value of life, I'm sure, has increased the more that you see. You see the value of not just your life, but those around you. And even probably with each person, each new patient that you work with, I'm sure that you just see that increased value all the time. And I think a lot of people take it for granted. You know, whenever I was 20, I was in the Navy, and I don't say this with any boast whatsoever, but I was living the Navy lifestyle, and I started having really, really bad panic attacks, and it immediately made me think, oh my gosh, I'm not immortal. You know, my goodness, what do I do? And so I started looking at life differently at that point. And honestly, I guess I'm kind of thankful for that experience, just because it did give me that wake up call that life is not forever. But I think there's a lot of people out there who are living as if tomorrow's always going to come. And that's just not the case. And like you stated, you know, it's death does not discriminate. You know, there is babies dying right now. There are people in their hundreds dying now, you know, mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, spouses, friends. You know, death is really the one true commonality. I know they say death and taxes, but a lot of people don't pay their taxes. So, so
So
death,
birth and death.
what's that? Birth and death?
Birth
Yeah,
and death.
that's it. That is it. So,
Yeah. And one thing that I try to help my clients with is, so there's a book called The Five Regrets of the Dying by Bronnie Ware. And the first one is, I wish I'd have the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life that others expected of me. And that's what I try to help people step into. And so, like, it's not so much about, like, how do we keep you alive longer? Like, my coaching doesn't revolve around longevity. It revolves around, like, how can you live your life the way that you want to be living it, with or without cancer? And I think, like, that's a really important question to ask anybody, of like, how do you want to be living your life right now, regardless of your current situation, regardless of your stressors? You know, how, what do you want to do? What do you want to experience? What do you want to, how do you want to live? Who do you want to be?
yeah, I've got one of my best friends in the world. His father was diagnosed with glioblastoma back about 3, 4 months ago. Had brain surgery. He's now gone through chemo and radiation. Seems to be hanging in there, but with disease such as glioblastoma, the outcomes are not very great. But
Sure.
what do you say to someone who's going through that to encourage them for the life that they still do have currently? What do you tell a person like that?
Yeah, I usually ask a lot of questions. I ask them, like, what's meaningful to you? What brings you joy? Did you have anything that you wanted to accomplish? And, like, so sometimes people are really sick and they can't, like, go climb Mount Everest if that was something on their bucket list. But what was the motivation for wanting to do something? So, like, if it was, I wanted to, you know, be a prolific writer and I didn't get to do, well, why did you want to be a prolific writer? Oh, I wanted to touch people. I wanted to share my story. I wanted to influence people. Okay, well, what's another way that we can do that? Like, maybe it's recording your story so that other people can hear it. Maybe it's talking to one person. And so, like, there's, you can make meaning wherever you are and with whatever capacity you can. And so I like to tell people that there's never no hope. It just, maybe what you hope in changes. So, like, maybe the hope isn't longevity anymore. But you can still hope in meaningful relationships. You could hope in reconciliation. You could hope in having joyful experiences. You know, like, there's other things that we can hope for. And maybe it's not what we expected, but there's never no hope.
Yeah, I've heard you say the word expectations or expected a few times, and that is something that I definitely challenge my clients on, is to really remove expectations from their vocabulary, and really change it for hopes or wishes. And I think it's a great alternative because a hope or a wish, I think, is something that does make us truly feel hopeful, whereas an expectation generally leaves us with disappointments. And I've mentioned it before on this podcast that there was some professor years ago that said high expectations produce high results, low expectations produce low results. I don't buy into that. I just feel like anytime someone expects something and it's not fulfilled, it's going to leave them with disappointments. But if I can
Yeah.
hope, like you said, I may not be able to hope for tomorrow, but what if I do restore that relationship with a child or a friend or relative? Is that worth it to me? And that's really what I think we have to dig into with people in those last moments, is what is this worth to you? You know, because we can push again our thoughts, our agendas on people inappropriately. One other question that Yeah, go ahead.
Well, can I make a comment on the expectations? So
Yeah.
I think it's Steve Chandler. He's a well-known coach, but he talks about expectation as there's only like two outcomes to expectation. Either somebody meets it or like the expectation is met and you feel kind of like neutral because you expected it anyway. So like who cares? Or you're disappointed
Yeah.
if the expectation isn't met. So there's no opportunity for joy, for celebration, because it's just like, all right, well, I expected it anyway. It's either neutral or it's disappointment.
Yeah, the ceiling is already established when you have an
Right.
expectation. You can't get beyond that. Like so, no, I completely concur. You had mentioned bucket list. I'm curious, do you have a bucket list?
Do I?
Yeah.
Don't think I do, actually.
That's so awesome. I actually don't either. There's nothing, I told my daughter walking her down the aisle last year was the last thing that I'd ever asked for. And she's like, "You don't want to see your grandchildren?" And I'm like, "No, of course I want to see my grandchildren, but it's
It's
not
not about
something that,
want.
yeah, I've just never asked for it. Like it's, I don't know. It was maybe it
There,
was my own expectation that was the only thing I wanted to do.
yeah, it's like there are things that would be nice for sure. Like there are
Sure.
things that I look forward to. I'm actually really bad at forward thinking, which may be that might be like a result of years of oncology nursing. But like I have, if you ask me my 5-year plan, I'd be like, I don't know. But I'm trying to do what feels meaningful now.
So
And I think that like there are things that would be nice, like, oh sure, I'd like to travel more. I'd like to, do this and that. But there's nothing that I feel like I have to do to live a life well lived. I already feel like the life that I get is a privilege.
that's awesome. And it sounds like our thoughts are very similar in that. But Abby, I would look and ask anybody listening to this podcast currently, if I ask them what their 5-year plan was 5 years ago, would you be living it right now? And I would say 99% of the people would say no, because COVID changed all of our lives, right? We
Oh, yeah.
that was a curveball that none of us expected. We didn't, life's not going to go back to the way it used to be either. Like this is life. So
And
I
so
feel
many people
like,
lost so many people in COVID. Like,
yeah.
so many loved ones were lost in COVID that the world doesn't even look the same as it did.
No. But I like the fact that you state, life is a privilege, and it absolutely is. And I don't, there are still things that I want to do, but there's nothing I have to do. I don't need to see the Eiffel Tower. I don't have to travel to Fiji, or there's nothing left for me that I would say I have been cheated.
Yeah.
I feel like life has been good. Does that mean I want to stop living? Absolutely not. I want to keep moving, keep, progressing. One thing I will share for you, and I've shared it on a fairly recent podcast, but I found something recently that said we need something to look forward to, that it's more pleasing on the brain to have something to look forward to than actually doing the event or recalling the event later in our memory. So, for example, I've got a cruise in October that I'm going on to Bermuda, and it's like, I'm really looking forward to that. It keeps me, when I go to work every week, it's like this is why I do it, because I can do those things later on. But again, if I don't get to Bermuda, it's not that big of a deal. I'm happy to have air in my lungs and just keep moving.
Like there might be people out there who do, have a lot of things that they want to do, and I think like that's great too. Just me personally, like I don't. And I think that like, yeah, if there are things that you want to do, just hold them with an open fist. Like if there are things that you want to do, that's wonderful. But your life is still meaningful with or without those things.
Yes.
So appreciating you appreciating what you bring to the world as meaningful, is more important than those things.
Yeah. So tell me more about the coaching side of you.
So I help folks who, like I said, have been touched by cancer, so they're either living with cancer or they're post living post cancer if the cancer is, in remission, or sometimes people are in long-term treatment, so they have, stage 4, you never stop treatment, and sometimes that can be really hard too. That's kind of a unique position to be in, because your whole life, the way that you thought your life would look, is different. And so, like, there are some people who can do their cancer treatment and then be done, and there are some people who can't. It's a whole life thing, and so helping people to come to terms, kind of with their complex emotions, helping people. Guilt, grief, and fear come up a lot. Helping people move through those complicated emotions, and then advocate for themselves within the healthcare system. I think, like, that's really hard, because the healthcare system is challenging as a patient to navigate, and as a caregiver as well. Like, you just sometimes don't know what you don't know. So sometimes having a somebody who knows in your corner can be really helpful. And yeah, like, trying to lean into a life that feels meaningful, however it looks right now. So with or without cancer. And so and working with caregivers, I try to help them to process their big feelings, and also make room for themselves too, because it's so tempting to make your whole life about that person who is sick, that you forget that you also need tending to. So trying to help them remember themselves as well.
So I'm going to ask you the hard question. Do you do that for yourself?
Do I do it for myself? I do. And there's room for improvement.
Okay, that's fair.
I think that if you talk to a nurse, a lot of us, we're caregivers, we do put off our own needs. So, like, if you ask a nurse, have you eaten lunch? Typically the answer is no. And that's just kind of the nature. We get very used to that, delaying our own needs for the needs of others. But there are things that I'm pretty strict about. I do a lot of my own caregiving. I love to read. I love to exercise. I love to be outside. And I spend time reflecting. I do try to not overschedule myself. I try to go to bed. Like, all of those things that I need to do, have kind of become non-negotiables, because I know that I couldn't do what I love to do, which is this, if I don't do those other things. Like, I know I'll burn out. So it's become a little bit strict, but there's always room for improvement.
Have you read Nurse Hadley's book, The In-Between? Are you familiar? She's a hospice nurse.
No, I haven't.
It's really like some of the things that you're talking about really connect with what I'm reading in that book. And I'm reading a few books right now. My ADHD sends me all over the place, but I need to finish this book. It's really good. But a lot of it is about her personal life, but it's really a good look into the life of a nurse, especially a hospice nurse, and some of the things that she sees, and that's really what the book is about. Like, what do people see in those end life times? Is it a dead relative that comes to visit them? Is it my wife's aunt recently passed away 2 or 3 weeks ago, and she was seeing butterflies at the end, and people asked, like, what color are the butterflies? And she said they're white, except there's one black one. And it's like there were no butterflies in the room. But why do people see what they do? Anyway, it's really interesting book, but you
Yeah.
also see her thought process, times of exhaustion, times of being re-energized. So it's a really neat look into the life of a nurse. And I don't know. It's if you
Yeah.
like books like that, I definitely recommend it.
Yeah, I will. I'll look into it. One thing that I think is unique for healthcare providers, especially ones who work in hospice or oncology, is that like we have this proximity to grief, yet we are not really expected to engage with it. And I think that that's something that could use space on our part of like, we get attached to patients. We see them through their cancer experience, and sometimes that's a long time. Sometimes I work with people for years, months or years, and you get close to them, you get close to their families, and then you watch them decline. And then when they do pass, it's hard because you feel that loss, and then you have to go into the next patient and be the cheerleader. And so like that kind of compartmentalizing is really challenging, and I think can be damaging if there isn't room to process it later. So like room to explore that loss and feel that loss, even if you can't do it at work in the moment when you're going from room to room and patient to patient. But like, how can you make sure that you still have space to feel it later? And I think that that's one thing that really helps with resilience and being able to do this job long term is making space to process those losses.
Yeah, in counseling, we've got kind of like peer support for those types of things. Where I'm out in the grief community on Facebook, I know that there's actually, I guess, communities like that for those that work in funeral services, which I think is great. I'm curious, do nurses have a place like that to be able to process some of the things they see? Any type of groups out there?
No, I'm sure there are. I don't hear about them very often. I do talk to my coworkers because we get attached to people and we see them go together. But I know that most hospitals have some sort of emotional support resources for staff, but they're usually short term. So typically, I think that nurses and doctors probably could use more support than they do, more emotional support than they do, just to even check in, even if it's not like one big event that happened, just to like check in on you because you are witnessing a lot. So just checking in to make sure that you're okay and taking care of yourself before you burn out, I think would be helpful. So I think that like it's great for healthcare providers to have a therapist or counselor or somebody that they talk to process some of that.
Yeah. Well, what other thoughts do you have? Anything that we're missing here?
I think I'd like to share a quote from David Kessler, and it's something that I come back to again and again. He says that each person's grief is as unique as their fingerprint. But what everyone has in common is that no matter how they grieve, they share a need for that grief to be witnessed. And I think like it's really powerful what you're doing, Brad, is bringing that witness to folks in their grief stories. And that's what I'm trying to do as well. And I think if there's people out there listening who have experienced grief or they know somebody who's experiencing grief, just let them tell their story. Even just storytelling is so powerful. And can be really healing without trying to fill that space, without trying to cheer them up. Just let them tell it and witness them. This is really powerful.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It is something that needs to be witnessed, and that's part of us stating that what I'm feeling is real, and somebody sees that. One of the things earlier on in our conversation that I thought was really powerful, and maybe I skipped by it when you had been talking about it, is the meaning making of grief. I feel like sometimes the death of an individual actually brings on meaning through others. And, when we go back to your story of Frank, Frank's death really had a huge impact on the whole trajectory of your life. Someone that you did not know before that day,
He
and if
never
you,
spoke to me, never knew my name,
isn't
never,
that interesting?
And it's just in his passing that he made that big impact on me.
Yeah.
You just never know.
I often refer to the pillars of my life, the things that I stand on that were difficult, but really breaking it all down makes me the guy that I like. And, I'm sure that was an impactful moment, a difficult moment. But then when you look at everything that's come after, every family that you've helped, every patient that you've worked with, through sickness and potentially death, like, wow, what a story to tell, that you have found meaning. How would you encourage others, I guess, to find meaning through their grief?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that so sometimes people feel like everything happens for a reason, and you might believe that, you might not. But sometimes I think, like, even if there's not a reason, like, I don't think like there's a reason that you get cancer and suffer, but there's always an opportunity to make meaning of any situation. And so, like, finding that meaning, whatever is meaningful to you. And sometimes that does take a little bit of self-exploration, because sometimes we don't know ourselves well enough to know what that is. But talking to somebody about like that, who can help you draw that out of yourself, can help you to then find out what's meaningful. Because sometimes we're just in these depths that we can't see out of, but you can have somebody help pull you out of it so you can see more clearly. And just somebody to ask you questions, not to like tell you what you should do, but just to help you find that inner wisdom that can help guide you. And sometimes that's a professional, sometimes that's a family or a close friend, but somebody safe to help you process that.
Yeah. Self-exploration. I think what's before self-exploration is probably fear. And
Yeah.
it's how do you step away from that fear, or be able to say that I'm going to have the courage to do some internal work and look at, what is good for me? How do I want to, or how can I find meaning through this grief? And more importantly, how can I use this? And I feel like you're using it in a great way to help others. I think grief is a powerful motivator. If people are willing to, I don't want to say harness it, but at least just uncover the power that grief has, and be able to maybe channel that into other areas that are beneficial, as opposed to tearing ourselves down and letting the grief win, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, because grief is not something that you ever get over.
No.
It's not something that goes away. You just learn to live with it. And sometimes you can transform it into something positive or meaningful. And sometimes it's just something that you live with. And grief is love. You don't grieve something that you didn't love. So I think that, thinking of it as an extension of love, it's not going anywhere. How do I learn to make this a part of my life? Brett, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
You mentioned that before self-exploration is often fear. What do you think that people are afraid of?
Sometimes I'm afraid that people are fearful of happiness. You know, like, what does it look like when I let all this go? Or, so I think that's a big piece of it, is just what does it look like to finally let go of these burdens that I've been holding on to. It's kind of like
Fear
if
of
I,
the unknown, like you
yeah,
don't know what it would be like to let go of them. So
sure.
I don't know what life would even look like without carrying around this really heavy backpack of stuff, you know?
That's it. That's it.
Yeah.
And I always talk about people becoming comfortable, you know, that I can hold a burden for so long that I become numb and I don't even recognize the weight of that burden. But if someone like myself or like you comes along and says, "Let me hold that for you for just a moment." And when and you know, it's like, take a deep breath, relax, just what does that feel like to let go of that for just a moment? If you want it back, I'll give it back to you. But what does it feel like? Explain that to me. And if people can describe that moment of just letting go, I think they'll see the, oh my gosh, this was so heavy. How did I carry this? It's kind of like someone that loses an excessive amount of weight. I've had several people that I've known, I don't know, lose say 30 pounds. And it's like, all right, let me let you hold 30 pounds in your arms and let's see how long you can do it. And most people, you know, will just say, you know, they're not weightlifters here. They're going to let go of that within 5 to 10 minutes and say, my gosh, my arms hurt so bad. This, I didn't know what this extra weight was doing to me. I think that's what we do emotionally.
And I think that it's interesting because when you get really good at numbing, if you get really good at numbing the hard stuff and the uncomfortable stuff, you get good at it and then you numb the good stuff too. Like you can't just numb one thing. So like it's really hard to experience joy when you don't let yourself experience sadness or
Yeah.
anything hard. And I think like there's this bittersweetness to life that like you can't just have sweet all the time. It starts to lose meaning. Having that bittersweetness is just it's part of life. And the more that you can embrace the bitter, the sweeter things become.
You know, one of the other fears that kind of pops up in my mind is maybe the fear of disbelief that, okay, I've believed this for so long, whatever this is, and if I now believe something else, does it take away from you know, perhaps the person who passed away? Like, does their life lose meaning if I start believing something different now that they're gone? So I think that's a potential fear. Like if I can just keep on living the way I've always lived, that I don't have to challenge any false beliefs that maybe I've carried for a long time too. So I don't know. There we probably could stay on for 2 hours listing different types of fears,
Yeah.
but I would definitely challenge anybody listening to, you know, think about what fears are you hanging on that's keeping you from exploring new avenues for your own life after the loss of someone you love. You know, what's that look like to do some of that internal work and question maybe things that you've believed for a long time, you know, things that you really have no evidence to back. You know, that's one of the things I tell my clients often is look for the evidence for and against everything that you believe in. You know, like what says this is true? Like if I feel like I'm such a bad person, okay, give me the evidence that says that's true. And then give me the evidence that says that's false. Let's put it in that evidence filter and shake it all out and just see at the end of the day, are you believing something that's a lie? I don't know. There's a lot of people I don't think that's ready to challenge some of those false beliefs, but when you do, maybe it does get you closer to that person or that calling, like the person that you're supposed to be or have always been, and you just didn't realize it, or be able to reach out into that calling, just like you have with nursing. You know, I sit here and think, what would your life look like had you never met Frank? Like, never seen that. Would you have still found your way to this place? Maybe.
Yeah, hope so, but I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the great news is you don't have to worry about it. You're here, you're helping,
Yeah.
and I'm sure you're a great blessing to others. So I don't know.
Thank you.
Yeah.
One last thing I would probably tell people listening, like if you don't have a safe person, a journal is a really safe place to explore some of this. So
Yes.
if you don't know who to talk about these things with, you can just write them down. Because even just putting them on paper helps it not be, you don't have to carry it around. Like you can let it rest on the page, and you can do some exploring. I know that journaling has been a huge part of my exploration and has helped me tremendously. Process a lot of my own stuff. So I would recommend that if you don't have somebody to talk to, or even if you do, like do both.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of journaling. I keep a dream journal. I actively dream quite often. I don't know. It's kind of settled down for for a couple of weeks. I don't know. I'm like waiting for the next big dream to write down, but I really enjoy that. I do write some of my thoughts down with it, like what does this mean, or you know, how does this correlate with life? But I've got a journal from back when I was 18 years old, and I can look back and it's like, man, I was an idiot. I usually don't call myself names, but I look back and it's like, but I can remember what I was thinking then. I remember what I was doing. It is so neat to write something down because it is almost like a timestamp, and you can go right back to the thoughts, the feelings, you know. What was I believing during that time period?
Yeah.
Even with my dreams, like most people will forget a dream very quickly after they wake up. If I write a dream down, I can go back to dreams. I've been doing this for about 5 years, and I can go back, and it's almost like I am back in that dream. It's very
Wow.
vivid, but it's because I took the time to write it down. Now, that's another thing is time factor with journaling. A lot of people feel like I have to go in like, dear diary, and write, you know,
Yeah.
4 pages of stuff. And it's not that. Like, what if you just simply put down, today was a good day? Like, that's a great reminder when you're having a really bad day 3 weeks from now. You can go back and say, oh, you know, it has been better. I hope to get back to that. Right? Going back to hopes, not expectations, but I hope to get back to that point where I felt okay. And now you've got evidence that says you were okay. And I think it does build up that hope that you can be there again. So journaling doesn't have to be this great ordeal. I think just taking the time to do it and then create that discipline of doing it day after day after day, and then it becomes something that a person enjoys.
And if you're not somebody who knows what to do with a blank page, there are like journals with prompts, or you can just Google like journaling prompts, and there's a bunch on the internet that are for free. So like if you're somebody who's like, I don't know what to write about, there's always something. And so even it's like, what's your favorite thing about you? Write a page about that. And sometimes I was like, oh, I never thought about that before. What is my favorite thing about me? And then you write it and you're like, oh, I'm pretty great. You know, it can really make your day. So there's lots of different ways to journal, and yeah, there's lots of resources out there if you don't feel like you know how.
Yeah, One of the journals out there that I've seen people use a lot is by Clever Fox, I believe. That's supposedly a good one. And I think it does have a few, I don't know, Kickstarters as far as getting people to journal. But one other thing I'll throw out, and I have no affiliation with this company, but we bought it for my mom back in February. It's called StoryWorth. Have you seen that?
I'm not.
It is the coolest thing. It's probably storyworth.com, I imagine. But I found it on Facebook, well, after my sister said, let's get this for mom. So basically what it is they send my mother prompts one per week, and it's like, tell me what your relationship with your father was like, or tell me a time in childhood that you were scared. Tell me your greatest achievement, when you were a teenager. So it prompts every single week. Now, what's really cool is when she does one, it actually sends that to me and my two sisters, and we can also control the questions. So if there's a question we want our mom to answer, we just put it, high on the priority list. But what's really cool is at the end of the year, they print it in book form. And I think it's
That's
really cool. It's
nice.
like $100. Like,
Yeah.
it's really cool. But for those who are fearful of journaling, maybe this just gets you out of your head and onto paper, and certainly you can still write about, loss and grief and things like that. It's you don't have to stick right with their prompts, but I don't know, just a cool tool.
And then you get like this book at the end that you can like share your story with other people. That's pretty neat.
Yeah. And I think you can purchase extra copies or something for a discounted price. Anyway, very cool thing. Well, Abby, any final thoughts to leave us with, or anything that you think that we missed? You're always welcome back. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. It has been. This has been fun. No, I think I'm good to leave it there. I feel like there's probably a lot more things that I could say, but if I go, then I'm just going to keep going. So,
Yeah, as soon as
yeah.
I hit stop on recording here, that's when it'll be like, oh yeah, I forgot. So we'll definitely have to do an episode two at some point. So
Thank
anyway,
you.
I appreciate you being here, and listeners, I thank you for being here, and hope you've been encouraged by Abby's story. Please reach out to her. I'll have her email and website there and available in the show description. We'll catch you next time, and hope everybody has a great day.